Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto. Each week, we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in Scripture and what's happening in our lives and in the world. Most weeks, the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time, we're joined by guest preachers. In this sermon, Reverend Harris reflects on the sixth requirement, do not kill. This is one of the requirements Jesus quotes directly. But Jesus calls us to look within and examine not just our behavior, but our feelings, thoughts, and motivations. Angry feelings can lead to angry words that can lead to angry actions. Violence starts within. Reverend Harris invites us to see the requirements as signs that point us away from the action they describe. So this requirement calls us to live nonviolently and aim towards love.
So does it say do not kill, or does it say do not murder? Biblical scholars are divided. For instance, Wilma Ann Bailey, in her book, You Shall Not Kill or You Shall Not Murder, The Assault on a Biblical Text, makes the convincing case that it should be do not kill. She goes into the Hebrew and does a very careful analysis of the Hebrew. And in addition to that work on the language, she also maintains that the change from kill to murder in some modern translations reflects the translator's desire to say that things like war or capital punishment do not violate this requirement. So there was like a political pressure to change it from kill to murder. But on the other end of the spectrum, Patrick Miller, in his Interpretations Bible Commentary, The Ten Commandments, also does a lot of language analysis and makes a strong and convincing case that it should be do not murder. To illustrate how close the divide is, Miller says that the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, which was the mainline Protestant standard until the late 80s, translates the word as kill. But the new Revised Standard Version that was published in 1989 changed it to murder. Patrick Miller, who was on the translation committee for the new Revised Standard Version, writes that making the change came down to a committee vote, and it was a tie. And so the chair broke the tie in favor of murder. Most of that debate is very academic, with lots of discussion about whether in other parts of the Bible, the same word that's used for murder or kill is used in a different context. What is the meaning of that word in the context? Because in the Ten Requirements, there is no context. It's just two Hebrew words, lo rashak, no murder, no kill, but no context. But in practice, the difference between do not kill and do not murder as one of the Ten Requirements is profound. Murder is the intentional and unlawful killing of a human being. Now, at least two major kinds of killings are not covered by that definition, which I've already mentioned. Capital punishment and war are both technically legal, so would not be murder under that definition. But if the Hebrew really means do not kill, then capital punishment and war, whether legal or not, would be violations of the requirement. You could even make the case that if it simply says do not kill, that killing animals would violate the requirement. Or as Wilma Ann Bailey says, the word kill has a much more expansive semantic field than the word murder. Now, personally, I'm on team do not kill, and I'll tell you why. I've been suggesting repeatedly in this series that the proper interpretation and application of these principles is not simply to treat them as these legal limits, but that we're supposed to kind of dig beneath the surface, go beneath the literal meaning, and find the buried treasure beneath each requirement to illuminate for us some sort of new way of life. So in that spirit, I think I'd like to offer another way of thinking about these 10 requirements that I think the sixth one is a great way to introduce. So the requirement, do not kill, is kind of like a neon sign flashing at the end of a, edge of a cliff. Flashing neon sign at the edge of a cliff, but it's not right at the edge of the cliff. It's somewhere in the vicinity of the cliff. The cliff, by the way, is just a sheer drop of hundreds of feet to your certain death. So there's no survival if you fall over the cliff. Oh, and by the way, it's dark out. So we're walking along in the dark, and we come to this flashing neon sign that says, "Do not kill." But that's not all it says. It goes on, it says, "If you go past this sign, you may fall to your death. So turn around and go back in a different direction." That's all in flashing neon letters. So in this illustration, when it comes to killing, there are things that we may be able to get away with if we are very careful or even lucky. We may be able to go past the sign and live. We just don't know how far past we can go. We don't know when we're going to fall off the cliff because it's dark. So for instance, if you kill an animal to feed your family and you kill the animal with reverence and respect, you're probably not going to fall off the cliff. You will be beyond the sign, "Do not kill," because you have killed something, but you probably won't fall off the cliff for killing an animal. But if you kill thousands of animals a day in a cruel fashion in a factory farm, maybe you are going to fall off that cliff. If you kill a person accidentally, that's technically not murder. We even have a word for it, manslaughter. If you kill, even if it's an accident, even in an accidental killing, you've still killed someone. Terrible things happen. Hit a pedestrian or something like that on the road and somebody dies. You are going to be emotionally disturbed by that. You're going to probably need some therapy and some healing. You're going to probably want to have some kind of reconciliation with the family. A lot will happen, but you have not fallen off a cliff, according to this illustration. A truly accidental killing is not a violation of this requirement. And multiple texts in the Bible actually support that fact. There's all of this stuff in the Old Testament about, well, don't kill, but if it's an accidental killing, well, that's a gray area. I know our lawyers are loving all this stuff, right? If someone attacks you and is trying to kill you, and you fight back and end up killing them, you probably won't violate the requirement and fall to your death. But who knows, really? Was there a non-lethal way to fight that person off, and did you take it? Did you kill them after you had already disabled them? So you disabled them, but you were so worked up that you went on and killed them. Are you in a stand your ground state and you have killed someone who wandered onto your property, though you may be legally off the hook? Were you too eager to take that life, and therefore have you violated this requirement and fallen to your death? Are you a police officer who has killed someone, and has your decision to use lethal force been influenced by racism? By your own racism or your own fear? Are you controlling a drone that is about to bomb a speedboat in the Pacific? Does just following orders get you off the hook? When do you fall off the cliff? What if you own stock in the company that made the drone? When do you fall off the cliff? When have you violated this requirement? The point is that anytime we take a life, we are in some moral danger. We have passed the sign, "Do not kill," and somewhere past that sign is a point of no return. We are in danger of violating this requirement and falling off the cliff. And that's why the sign says, not just "do not kill," but turn around, go in the other direction, get out of this area. Nothing good will come from you being in this area near this cliff. Which is exactly how Jesus approaches the requirement. We don't know exactly which word Jesus used, because he was probably speaking in Aramaic, and the New Testament is written in Greek, so we don't even have quotes from Jesus most of the time. But the Greek word is clearly murder. So that translation was the correct Greek translation of that word. But Jesus interprets that word not again as a legal definition, but as this sign near the edge of a cliff. Hey, turn around and go the other direction. You don't want to be in this area. He teaches us to not just avoid crossing a technical legal line, but to really go and look on it into our hearts, to look at our motivations, our feelings, our thoughts. Is there anything within us that might lead us to violence? And if so, turn around and go the other direction. Don't even wait until you get to the flashing neon sign. You have heard that it was said to those who lived long ago, don't commit murder, and all who commit murder will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with their neighbor will be in danger of judgment. They say to their neighbor, you idiot, you'll be in danger of being condemned by the governing council. If they say, you fool, you will be in danger of fiery hell. Yeah, it's that version of Jesus. That's Matthew's version of Jesus. The passage goes on, and it really gets a little convoluted and confusing, but there seems to be a trajectory to what Jesus is offering us here. Like, as if he's saying there are multiple signs before you even get to the big flashing one. So watch out for anger. Watch out for angry words. Watch out even when someone is angry with you, which is surprising. He's saying to us, take the initiative and seek peace with the person who's angry with you. So way before we even get to any kind of violence, are we doing things that go in the other direction? Murder, do not murder, do not kill is pointing us in a different way. It's not a line, it's a directional sign. It's the opposite direction of violence. And it's not just some line that we cross, but it's saying, if you have any violence in your heart, any in your action or in your actions, you're going in the wrong direction and you can turn around and get out of that territory. Dedicate your life to nonviolence. So considering all that, I want to take a minute to talk a little bit more about anger, because Jesus focuses in on it so clearly. But before I do, there is an elephant in the room to talk about when it comes to murder and killing. And that is the problem of people killing people is mostly a problem caused by men. Now, of course, we're feminists and women can kill people too. And not all men are killers, but the statistics are really remarkable. The UN Office of Drugs and Crime did a global study on homicide. And they found that 90% of homicide suspects are men. And 81% of homicide victims are men. That's a huge majority. And that doesn't include war. That's just your garden variety men killing each other. So men in particular need to pay careful attention to these teachings. And these principles are things that we especially need to teach to our boys. So with that in mind, let's talk about the anger thing for a minute, because according to Jesus, that's where it all starts. Anger is a normal human emotion. It's even healthy. It might arise when we feel threatened in some way. It might arise when someone we love is threatened. It might arise when we expect something to happen in a certain way and it happens in an opposite way. Anger might arise when we're startled. It's a good indicator within us that something is wrong. Something is wrong within us, something is wrong in the world. A little alarm bell that's going off. And if we can feel it and take some deep breaths and then calmly address the thing that caused the anger, we'll be in good shape. What we have to watch out for is when the anger doesn't go away or when the anger takes over. When are we acting or speaking not out of love, not out of righteousness, but out of anger? When we lash out, as the saying goes, anger is something that leads us, can lead us to violence if we hold on to it. This is supported by the Apostle Paul, who writes, "Be angry, but do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger." So anger is not the sin, it's the emotion that can lead us if we don't let it go. It can carry us toward the cliff. And though men are the ones who tend to get carried away into acts of violence and killing, women can also get carried away by anger. Women don't usually kill because of anger, but there are other ways that we can harm one another. And regardless, holding on to anger in any way is always something that's going to harm us more than the person that we are angry with. So Jesus says this stuff about managing anger as one way that we can walk away from the cliff. It's not the only way to walk away from the cliff in a direction of nonviolence. There are other ways. Prayer and meditation leads us away from the cliff. Learning to disagree with people without getting angry, to disagree in love, can take us away from the cliff. Being kind, getting to know our neighbors, offering forgiveness and grace when we are able, driving more peacefully. You know, going the speed limit is a life-saving practice and an underappreciated anger management tool. Being conscious of what we eat and eating as ethically as possible, where does our food come from? Supporting legislation and policies that invest in human well-being on a social scale, supporting legislation that demilitarizes and disarms the police. If we think about ever calling the police, this is an important one that doesn't happen very often, but if you ever think you need to call the police in a situation, to pause and really ask, is it necessary? Can we solve this thing without involving the police? Because police will always bring the threat of violence by definition. So can we handle a situation without bringing the threat of violence into it? We can speak out against war. We can divest from corporations that profit from war. And the list goes on and on, all the ways that we can live nonviolently, walk in the direction away from the cliff. In a world where there is so much killing, as Christians, part of our work is to demonstrate what it's like to live in the territory of nonviolence, what it's like to live far from the sign. And if we take these illustrations of the requirements being like signs at the edge of cliffs, if we take that to the extreme, then we're really living on a giant plateau surrounded by cliffs in all directions, and there are 10 signs telling us that the cliff is coming and to turn around and go back toward the center of the plateau. But we live in a world where the leaders call us to ignore the signs and just dance in the dark on the edge of the cliff. Or they tell us the signs really say murder and not kill, so it's safe to get closer. But Jesus teaches us to aim for the center. Live in the center of the plateau, because in the center is another sign that says, love is here. And that sign is the one that Christians should always be aiming for. We love each other and we love others and our enemies for our own well-being so that we aren't near the dangerous cliffs. And we love each other and our neighbors and our enemies to show the world that joy is found in the center. Now, I was going to end the sermon there, but I need to add an epilogue or an appendix or something, because I saw the movie The Odyssey on Friday night, and it made me think that this was what I just said was incomplete. Odyssey is a great movie, Christopher Nolan movie. There's a lot of violence, so if you're trying to reduce violence by not watching violent things, maybe it's not the right thing. But if you're okay with that, it's a really great movie, and what I was surprised by is that Christopher Nolan, from my interpretation, takes it in the direction of, this is a story about a man trying to find his way home after the trauma of war. So Odysseus has gone to Troy and defeated Troy and the Trojan horse thing, but what he saw there has conflicted him, and so the whole journey back is a story about a soldier trying to find his way home after the trauma of war. And I think it could be any of us who have experienced any trauma, trying to find our way home, and if that is even possible. And what it made me think about is that the cliff metaphor really isn't a good one, because it implies that there's a point of no return, that if we go in a certain direction far enough, we can never go back. And that's not what I believe about God. I believe that God is always calling us back. There's always the possibility of redemption, that there's always a possibility of grace and forgiveness. So maybe it's better to think of, instead of a cliff, just darkness and wilderness as far as you can see. So if you go past the sign and you keep going past the sign, you're just going to go into more and more darkness, more and more wilderness. But you can always look back and see that flashing sign and know that there's something calling you home. There's something calling you in a different direction. And I think we have to believe that, because The murderers in this world don't just fall off cliffs and disappear. They live among us, and we are them when we are all complicit in so much of the violence in the world. So it's all tied up. So our challenge then is to keep turning around. When we keep going in the direction of anger, leading us into violence, to keep turning back around and heading toward the center and heading toward love, knowing that a murderer in prison can be redeemed, and a soldier who's done terrible things in war can be redeemed, and all of us who fall short of living according to these ideals can be redeemed, because God's love is eternal. Amen.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.